start with some statistics. Why heart failure is an important topic, and you realize I'm saying heart failure, not congestive heart failure. I will talk about that later on. Because there are around 5 million Americans have been diagnosed with the disease. Every year there are around 500,000 newly diagnosed with heart failure regardless of the etiology. Hospital discharge with heart failure increased 155% in the last 20 years. And it's the most frequent cause of hospitalization for people above age 65. Which are most of that we see, at least in my clinic. I don't know about the ER. Framingham Heart Study, which was started a long time ago, realized that between 1950-1999, there was a little bit change in heart failure diagnosis between men, but declined in women overall. And we have to consider also the increase of population during that time, but the survival was similar in both genders. This is from that study. It showed what happened between men and women taking the time difference here. And you realize that hasn't been much a change, and it wasn't statistically significant eventually, although the numbers fluctuated over time. Also, the mortality estimate divided between 30 days, men and women, 1 year and 5 years. We realize there's decrease in the mortality overall throughout all these years. There hasn't been much a change in the 30 days mortality, but if you take the 5 years mortality, there was some significant change between them. And this is a trend for 5 years mortality between men and women, considering the time era here where we took these statistics, starting from 1979 to 2000 and dividing them between men and women, and this is the year difference. So each year except between 1985 and 1995, there wasn't much difference here, but starting from 1979 to 2000 in both genders was significant difference, especially between 1990s and 2000. And if you go back and think about why did that happen, that's where the most of the literature about a treatment of heart failure and application of the new methods of management and the new ideas of heart failure started, starting with the first trials of ACE inhibitor and beta blockers in 1989 when the consensus trial was conducted. The relative risk of death after the onset of heart failure, according to Framingham definition of heart failure, divided by age and between men and women, starting here, 1979, and going forward, there is a significant decrease of the relative risk of death, and all because of the new management, which we're going to talk about it later on. So this is the trend of mortality between 1994 and 1999 in a trial I think published back, yes, 2009, last year. So the black columns here reflects the in-hospital mortality after diagnosis of myocardial infarction and heart failure, and this is the red one, in-hospital mortality of heart failure death. And this is the trend, the cumulative heart failure in 5 years, also mortality. You realize that with the black columns here, there's a significant decrease of mortality due to myocardial infarction, but there is decrease of the incidence of in-hospital heart failure. So we were very successful in managing heart attacks in hospitals, but that led to development of heart failure. We did decrease the mortality over time between 1994 and 1999 due to myocardial infarction, but look what we did with the mortality of heart failure. We helped these patients to live longer, but they developed heart failure later on, and we'll see why that happened. Now, so what's heart failure? Again, realize we're not using congestive heart failure. It's a multi-system disorder. Start with decreasing of the cardiac output, cardiac index, that characterized by abnormalities in the cardiac muscle or led to abnormalities in the cardiac skeletal muscle, renal dysfunction due to decrease of perfusion, and that will stimulate the countermeasures of sympathetic nervous system and very complex pattern of neurohormonal changes to push the cardiac muscle to improve the cardiac output, to counteract what happened here. So the primary impairment, as I said, is decrease of the cardiac output and the cardiac index and activation of the compensatory mechanisms. So what causes heart failure? Why do we go into that condition called heart failure? Something going to happen to the pump, which is the heart. Cardiomyopathy is what happened. And there are multiple etiologies of cardiomyopathy. The most and the common one, and everybody knows, is the myocardial infarction, coronary artery diseases. Basically, portion of the heart will die because of infarction, lack of blood supply, heart attack, acute or chronic. So part of the pump won't work, decreased cardiac output and cardiac index. Myocarditis can cause cardiomyopathy eventually, but that will be non-ischemic. Valvular disease. In this stage of any valvular disease can cause to cardiomyopathy. Think about it. Severe aortic stenosis not managed. It will end with cardiomyopathy, but not due to this, due to different etiology. Toxic cardiomyopathy, such as chemotherapy, infiltrative diseases, amyloid, genetics. Some people just will have cardiomyopathy. There are some rare genetics, such as familial restrictive cardiomyopathy. I've seen only one case through my career. There are other kind of genetics who will tell you, well, my mom at age 35 had cardiomyopathy. She died at age 40. My aunt, my uncle. And here I am with the cardiomyopathy. Sometimes we don't know what kind of the genes. You just have to look into the family. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And there is a special entity called diastolic heart failure, where all of these will affect the ejection fraction with the drop of the ejection fraction, except diastolic heart failure, where you have a preserved ejection fraction, such as portion of infiltrative diseases at the beginning, where the heart stiffens, the end diastolic pressures will increase, the heart cannot relax, therefore cannot accommodate enough blood to generate enough cardiac output, or stroke volume causing of decrease of the cardiac output. Although if you look at these heart on the echoes, the ejection fraction, the number reported is normal or maybe hyper. And the last one, right ventricular dysplasia is, or arrhythmogenic ventricular dysplasia can cause also cardiomyopathy. The initial insult to the heart can give you heart failure, cardiopathy, or symptoms. So you get the initial insult from whatever list I put before. If you cardiomyopathy, a drop of the fraction. That doesn't mean the patient have heart failure. It might condition might into heart failure or might not. But you will generate this cardiomyopathy. Therefore, cardiomyopathy does not mean heart failure. Heart failure will happen due to cardiomyopathy. However, having cardiomyopathy doesn't mean heart failure. Therefore, the word congestive heart failure have been taken out of the medical literature in 2005. There is nothing called cardiomyopathy anymore. So when you use it, you're using a very old term. It's like saying to somebody, you have cancer. What does that mean? Is it a skin cancer? Something the dermatologist will scrape it? Or this is a cancer that's going to kill the patient next morning? All of them under the word of cancer. So there is nothing called congestive heart cardiomyopathy. When you see a patient, I'll show you how to define that patient. So the word we're using now is cardiomyopathy, and if they are in fluid overload status, they are in acute heart failure, not congestive, because as I showed you, this entity, the patients are not congested. So the heart failure doesn't mean congestion anymore. So we have to be careful when you use these terms. These are the criteria for diagnosing heart failure. You need two major criteria or two major and one minor criteria to diagnose heart failure. Paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, neck veins if you can evaluate it, RAS, cardiomyopathy, or the minor criteria such as ankle edema, night cough. So not everybody with ankle edema, such as a lady who gave birth the day before, has some ankle edema, comes because she's tired, she cannot do her work a day after her delivery. We cannot label her with cardiomyopathy or heart failure because she doesn't meet most of these criteria. So it's very important to go through these criteria and see if you can match two major or one major and two minors criteria. Now, why we develop heart failure? Normally, heart failure, cardiomyopathy increases by age. Normally, everybody. The longer we live, the more likelihood we're going to develop heart failure due to any etiology of the etiology I gave you before. At any point of our life, we develop insult, and it's manifested here by acute myocardial infarction. At any point we develop insult to the myocardium, look what happened to the graft. It goes higher. Suddenly it shifts. So age-wise, and I think somebody did the statistics, if we live to age 110, we have 100% a chance of having heart failure, regardless of the etiology. Could be diastolic, it could be systolic. This is statistically speaking. But it definitely increases by age. And you know that from your work, that you have patients with heart failure or cardiomyopathy in their older ages than they are younger. And how often do you see somebody with age 20 or less with cardiomyopathy or heart failure? Way less than somebody 65 and above. And that's statistically correct. So this is a trial published in 2009, taking a look at the patient who had myocardial infarction. So what happened? 7,733 patients had myocardial infarction. Look how many developed heart failure. 5,800. 23 of them ended with death within 30 days. 771 didn't have the chance to develop heart failure, they just died. And 1,000 had no event. So the majority of these patients developed heart failure due to the insult of myocardial infarction. So the whole problem starts with an insult to the myocardium. Again, here it's myocardial infarction, the most common one, but any insult to the myocardium will cause the pump to be weak, and you go through the vicious cycle of the myocardial, of the heart failure. This is the vicious cycle of the heart failure, or starting. It starts always with the insult, reduced systolic function. You activate the neurohormonal system. Why? Because you want to increase left ventricular end diastolic volume and pressure. At the same time, it starts giving you the vicious cycle. You increase wall stress, increase in neurohormonal activation. Why? Because you want to increase the cardiac output. At the same time, if you have myocardial infarction, the infarcted segment will expand because you increase oxygen demand by the myocardium due to the neurohormonal activation. So this area is already lacking the blood, cannot tolerate this kind of stress. So the infarcted area will get larger. The non-infarcted segment start doing hypertrophy, or so we called it remodeling. You see, remodeling in your kitchen is very good. You want to do that every few years. Remodeling in the heart is very bad. You change the geometry of the heart. The moment you change the geometry of the heart, you go into an entity called desynchrony of the ventricle. That means the ventricle will not be able to pump the blood enough. Either you have aneurysmal wall changes, or you have abnormal wall movement where the heart is not effectively ejecting the blood anymore. So you develop more heart failure, and of course it says death here. So poor ventricular function, heart failure, decreases stroke volume, neurohormonal response. What are these neurohormones? Renin angiotensin aldosterone system, or the RAS, and the sympathetic system. Why they get activated? Because they want to do vasoconstriction. They want to increase your preload, and unfortunately increase the afterload after that. You want to generate more blood pressure. You want to perfuse the other organs. So initially, it's a very helpful step, but not eventually. And that will increase sympathetic tone, angiotensin 2, endothelin, impaired nitric oxide release, all to cause the vasoconstriction, and the aldosterone cause the sodium retention, the fluid overload, the one you see the patient. This is the reason for the fluid overload, which started as a compensatory mechanism, ended with developing the symptoms of the heart failure, such as shortness of breath and pulmonary edema. Further stress on ventricular wall, remodeling, leading to worsening of ventricular function, and further heart failure, and the circle start turning around unless we break it. So the activation of the sympathetic nervous system in the heart failure, either via low or high pressure baroreceptors, because of decreased the cardiac out stroke volume and mainly the cardiac output, it increased the pre and afterload. Increased preload is good, but eventually it will lead to fluid overload, especially when you increase the afterload. The afterload is the pressure in the arterial system that the heart is trying to push against. So if the pump is weak and you're increasing the afterload, that makes the work of that pump is harder. The heart, the sick heart cannot pump enough blood or have enough effort to generate against that afterload. More failure. So this is good at the beginning to increase the blood pressure to perfuse organs. Eventually it's going to come and hunt the sick heart again. The earliest increase of activities is in the heart, and that precedes the sympathetic stimulation of the skeletal muscles and the kidneys. So the first effect, which is intentionally made for, is to help the heart pump blood before we see that effect in the periphery. But later on, we start seeing that effect on the muscles, on the kidneys, such as worsening of the perfusion to the kidneys, elevated cardiac, elevated creatinine, and causing muscle fatigue. The patient now can walk less than a block and get short of breath. And this is contributing in addition to decreasing of the cardiac output. The chronic sympathetic activation, however, has deleterious effect, as I said, causing further deterioration in the cardiac function. It's not also on the function and the pressure game in the heart, preload and afterload. It can cause apoptosis. It can cause hypertrophy and also necrosis on the cellular level because of too much activation. So the more we let vicious cycle go, the more deleterious effect we have on the heart, and it goes on and on and on. So livers and brain have the renin substrate. This is the renin-angiotensin system. The renin goes to the kidneys and converts angiotensin 1. This, which we target in our treatment, helps the angiotensin 1 to become a potent vasoconstrictor, which is the angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2 helps release aldosterone. Aldosterone helps retain the salt and water because they want to increase the preload and afterload in response to the decrease of the stroke volume. But also angiotensin 2, I said, a potent vasoconstrictor and enhanced sympathetic activity. So this will give you more heart failure, trigger this again, and goes on. And this is, again, the vicious cycle. Myocardial damage is the same thing, activation of the sympathetic nervous system. I'm stressing on this more and more with more slides because I want you to understand the concept of heart failure and why do we need to break the vicious cycle. Unless you do something to this vicious cycle, it's going to continue and eventually increase in mortality. Renin angiotensin, fluid retention, vasoconstriction, increased wall stress, myocardial oxygen demand. In a sick muscle, you cannot do that. So decrease contractility and death after that. So in the long term, the ability of the myocardium to respond to chronic high concentration of catecholamines lead to something else, attenuation and degradation of beta receptors. So less response to catecholamines from the heart. This is one of the concepts initially started using beta blockers in these patients. The response is associated with baroreceptor dysfunction also, and also with the sinus node dysfunction. The abnormalities of baroreceptor function are well documented in chronic heart failure, along with reduced parasympathetic tone because you have too much sympathetic stimulation. Now, again, why is that is bad? We said it can cause necrosis. It's the vicious cycle, but in a trial looked into heart failure patient, as I forgot which trial did that, they measured concentration of plasma or epinephrine and correlated with mortality. And sure enough, patients who have more norepinephrine died more in 5 years comparing to people who had less. So clinically, this is, we don't follow it, because the management of the patient is the same, because we know the vicious cycle. So we don't need to see how much norepinephrine to give the patient more beta blockers or its inhibitor. But it's very important to know that patient who's compensating more, have more norepinephrine in their body, they die more. So it is beneficial initially, but that proves to you, look the significant difference here. 2 years, just 24 months, look how much p-value difference between these three, and look what happened after 60 months in these patients. Also, part of the compensating mechanism is producing the BNP, the prenatriuretic peptide, which is produced from actually the left ventricle in response to stretch of the ventricle. So it's the pre-PNP and then becomes the PNP, and it comes from the atrium, but mainly from the ventricle. It does come actually from the right ventricle. And I don't know if you noticed that, but your patient who come to you because of pulmonary embolism without any heart disease, if you measure their BNP, it is mildly elevated in response to stretch from the RV. Why it is mildly elevated? Because the myocardium in the right ventricle is way less than the myocardium than the left ventricle. Therefore, the right ventricle cannot generate much BNP. That's the reason. But you need to be careful with these patients. I want to talk a little bit about PNP after we talked about all of that and the pathophysiology of heart failure. You all measure PNP in the emergency room, and we know why the PNP is being generated. And initially when PNP came out, and I think that's in 2002 when we started using it clinically, everybody used it as a diagnostic, the ultimate diagnostic test for heart failure. Unfortunately, with the literature came after that, it is not the case. Therefore, don't order BNP, please, with your heart failure patient for many reasons. These are the recommendation of the American College of Cardiology, and these are the guidelines for BNP. Class 2A indication measurement, and I cut and paste intentionally, just to show you what they say. Measurement of natriuretic peptide or BNP or even a pre-BNP can be used in the evaluation of patient presenting to the urgent care setting, like emergency room, in whom clinical diagnosis of heart failure is uncertain. Measurement of BNP can be helpful in the risk stratification. They didn't say diagnosis. So if you're uncertain about it, 500-pound patient, short of breath, it's impossible to do a physical exam. You want to do something to tell, you do BNP. If the BNP is 200, it's not his heart, it's probably his lung. Okay? This is one of the reasons, and it's a class 1 actually indication. Concentration of BNP should be measured in patient being evaluated dyspnea in which contribution of heart failure is not known, such as obese patient. Final diagnosis requires interpreting these results in the context of all available clinical data and ought not to be considered a stand-alone test. BNP cannot be used to diagnose it. Don't call anybody to say, I have a heart failure patient because BNP is 5,000. It can be elevated in renal failure. It can be elevated in pulmonary embolism. Patient with old cardiomyopathy, diagnosed already with cardiomyopathy, their BNP is not normal. I remember I had a patient who was Myrinone dependent, 76-year-old female with horrible left ventricle. She's not a candidate for transplant for many reasons because of her age. She was on Myrinone as a continuous infusion. Her euvolemic BNP was 700. One day she presented to a nearby ER. They didn't know how to use the BNP. They saw the BNP 400. They start diuresing her. So if you think about it, if her euvolemic BNP is 700, she's 400, this is a clear indication of dehydration. She was dehydrated. So never use BNP as a standalone test. You need to use it in the context. So the only class 1 indication is to help you with the diagnosis when you don't know what's going on with this patient. Class 2B indication, the value of serial measurement of BNP that goes into the outpatient management of these patients to guide therapy in heart failure patients is not well established. In some heart failure clinics, especially in my clinic, I do use it on very few patients to measure the progress of their disease. It's not well established. It goes with the expert of the physician who's treating that. This is a pure outpatient test. This is the only guideline for BNB. There are no other guidelines for BNB. Therefore, when you use BNB, you want to consider it with the rest of the symptoms of the patient. Never use it as a standalone test. Never. And never use it to guide your therapy. Never use it to give the patient Lasix. Never. Now, how are we going to classify these patients with heart failure? Throughout the years, a lot of classification came out, trying to guide our therapy and trying to guide the progress of the disease in these patients. How can you tell this patient is responding to medical management versus not? It started with the New York Heart Association classification, which everybody uses. 6-minute walk, we rarely use it. It's used by the pulmonologist more than the cardiologist, and actually it's a wonderful test, and we should all use it. We don't use it much because you need the space to have the patient walk, and it takes time. Well, unfortunately, we don't know to do it. The ACC-HA classification, we'll go over it now. Clinical profile or fluid status. The famous one who represented actually the concept is Dr. Stevenson from Harvard, I think in 2003, her paper, I'll show you now. And the VO2 stress test, where we measure the VO2 and the anaerobic threshold in this patient. We tend to do that test just before giving the patient heart transplant to see what's their functional capacity. We don't do it here. This is the ACC-AHA guidelines, and this is their stages. They came to say that NOHA classification is a functional classification, but it really does not differentiate the patient based on the etiology and other factors. Therefore, they created the stages. And it's, in a way, it's a scary stage. If you look at it, stage A, who's in stage A heart failure? Now, these patients would be labeled heart failure as a stage A. Diabetic patient, without any dysfunction of their ventricle. Polyc syndrome, they are stage A heart failure. They don't have any heart disease. If you have an echo on them, maybe the echo is totally normal. They anything. But what I tell you here, they are on their way, and they are on the first step to develop heart failure in the future. You need to pay attention to them, and the only treatment there is treating their disease. There's nothing specific about heart failure treatment in these patients. But they're telling these patients are on your way to become a failure patient. Stage B, patient who had the previous cardiac infarction, such as ischemic heart disease, the ejection fraction is normal. But as I showed you before, the insult to the myocardium has happened. It's a matter of time for these patients to develop symptoms of heart failure, and they go into the cardiomyopathy. The patient with low ejection fraction, that means when we read it between 50 to 55, when we read our echoes, this is called low normal. It's really not totally normal. It's not totally low. It's in that stage. So there's an insult to the myocardium regardless of the insult. Now, that's a stage B. Those are seen mostly in a primary care physician clinics and some of them in cardiology clinic. Now, when they cross to stage C, that's when they develop the heart failure symptoms. And that these patients are usually on the carvedilol or metoprolol XL, ACE inhibitor as a treatment for heart failure. And this is the patient they get in trouble with the fluid overload. Now, this are the majority of the patients with heart failure seen in heart failure clinic or cardiology clinics. If they cross to stage D, and this is where the biggest trouble for them, this is when they fail the conventional medical management with pills when they are at home. They tend to come to the hospital more often. IV diuretics is not working. They require inotrope support, and these patients move to have transplant or left ventricular assisted devices. These are stage D patients. So I don't know if you've seen any of my notes before, but at the end of my note, every time I see a patient, I usually tend to classify them according to the New York Heart Association, because none of this classification is a good declassification per se. You have to use multiple classification to classify these patients. I use NYHA class, I use the ACC, and I use Dr. Stevenson class, this one. So Dr. Stevenson came, and this is actually started, I think, in the 1970s. There was a paper about it, but people never paid attention to it. Then in 2003, Lynn Stevenson from Harvard came up with this paper and defined this patient based on their A, perfusion, and she called it warm and cold, and their fluid status, dry or wet. So she mixed this patient into these four categories. Perfusion, are they perfusing well or not? Month ago, creatinine is 1. Today, creatinine 2.7. Patient is hypotensive. They are not perfusing well. Cold. They were warm. Now they are cold. Fluid status. Dry. Are they normal? Or wet? JVP is elevated. Lower extremities edema. 10 pounds weight gain over 5 days. Wet. And did this combination. Now remember this because we're going to go to the next two slides to show you that there is difference in mortality between these patients, how dry and warm, and these are the outpatient heart failure, well managed, taking their medication, well compensated, versus patients who are fluid overload and very low cardiac output or stroke volume, requiring different kind of treatment such as inotropes. And this is the C group. So if you look at the A and the C group, in 18 months, event-free survival, A did better than C, clearly. Stable patient, rock stable, versus unstable patient. And this is 1 year mortality. Again, A did better than C. Unfortunately, the number of the patient, if you look at the profile here, wasn't great, especially in L group, and we go back to see who's L group, dry and cold. So she didn't have enough patients to extrapolate good data on these two, but definitely comparing to the outpatient stable patient versus the unstable requiring inotrope support, they did significantly worse after time. Now we got to remember that all these classifications do not correlate with each other. For example, New York Heart Association class 1, that does not mean they are dry and warm. Most of them are, but that doesn't mean. So don't correlate. Therefore, this is the third classification I use on my note when I see this patient. Are they warm or cold? Are they wet or dry? So I use three classifications to classify my patient when I see them. And that will give you an idea about your patient when you see them. So these are the major classification. Now, what's the management for heart failure patients? This is the first medication came, the trial, consensus of trial, 1989, I think published in JAMA. YS inhibitor. Of course, we got the double-blinded multicentric trial, and it showed that this patient did very well. I think there was a 25% decrease of mortality in patients with heart failure who took S inhibitor versus no S inhibitor. So there's decreased afterload. Remember our culprit here, because of increased sympathetic activity, increased afterload. Well, that will decrease the afterload, decreasing the vasoconstriction. Why? Because it inhibits the ACE, which is taking the angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, which is a potent vasoconstrictor. That was the whole idea of starting the consensus trial. It also improved endothelial function. By decreasing the afterload, it helped emptying the left ventricle, decreasing the left ventricular end diastolic pressure, helping to empty the left atrium and facilitating this pulmonary congestion. Patients feel better. They also increase the resting subendocardial perfusion and coronary flow reserve, improving the myocardial function. And also the trial said it decreased mortality. And that's what happened to the vicious cycle. Again, ventricular performance decreases, decreasing cardiac output, activation neurohormonal system, and RAS system is part of it. So the angiotensin receptor, converting enzyme inhibitor comes up here, blocking this vicious cycle. So we have to break the cycle, and this is part of the blockade to the cycle. Now, this is another one to show you where the ACE inhibitor works, but at the same time, patients who are not eligible to take ACE inhibitor due to allergy or due to angioedema happened to them before, you cannot give them ACE inhibitor. ARB came up to be a very good alternative through multiple trials. And this is where the work of the ARB work is after the angiotensin forms, but it blocks the receptors and also is a very good alternative. But if your patient can take ACE inhibitor, don't give them ARB. It is not recommended. ACE inhibitor before ARBs. Aldactone. The whole idea of using aldactone is, when did it start? I think this is in the early 90s when they did the RASA trial. It directly stimulates the formation of myocardial fibrosis in the rat heart. So they use it on the rat and they saw decrease of the fibrosis. And this is where the whole idea came in these patients. We don't have evidence it does decrease the fibrosis in human heart. However, the RALZA trial showed significant decrease of mortality in these patients who were on beta blockers and ACE inhibitor at the same time. So it limits the amount, there's a limited amount of human data accumulate to support the concept of aldosterone-mediated myocardial fibrosis. Again, it's only in rats. Spironolactone use in addition to diuretics, ACE inhibitor, produced 20% reduction of serum liver markers of collagen deposition compared with the placebo. So they measured this in the blood, and actually they never did what they did to the rat hearts, thank God. Beta blockers. Beta blockers, we mentioned the sustained adrenergic stimulation of the myocardium, how it down-regulate the beta receptors, causing the heart less receptive of norepinephrine and epinephrine in the body. So activation of norepinephrine releases a raised cardiac output, and that will now regulate beta-1 adrenergic receptors and uncouple the beta-2 adrenergic receptor, leaving myocyte less responsive to adrenergic stimuli. So more stimulation is not good for the heart and decrease the contractile function. That's where the idea of beta blockers came. I'm just giving you the ideas. This is not the trial. There are a lot of trials. The last trial on beta blockers was the COMET trial published in beginning of 2004, where they studied carvedilol twice a day versus metoprolol tartrate, which showed significant improvement on carvedilol. So the multicentric double-blind trial showed improvement of patient or improved mortality in patient with heart failure regardless of the etiology of cardiomyopathy. Is it ischemic versus non-ischemic? One cat for beta blockers never start unless your patient is euphoric. Somebody comes on beta blockers and they are decompensated, the recommendation is to continue. If you're having trouble with beta blood pressure, drop it down to 50% of the dose. Never stop it because it takes a long time to use beta blockers in these patients. Beta blockers are poorly tolerated medication comparing to the other medications such as ACE inhibitor or ARBs. We take our time up-titrating medications versus cutting it down to zero and restarting it again is a big headache. If you have to do with somebody in cardiogenic shock, sure, but do not stop this medication just because your patient is mildly fluid overloaded. These are the trials I want you to be aware of. Capricorn, Mocha, Comet, Christmas, all of these trials are carvedilol trials. Metoprolol, succinate, which is Toprol XL, the NDC trial, Merit Heart Failure, and SPICE. ACE inhibitor, the famous trial is Consensus, and you have all these trials. HOPE trial is famous, published in 1999, SOLVE the trial, and VHEFT trial. Now, these are the methods came up to manage these heart failure patients. Beta blockers, ACE inhibitor, aldactone. The diuretics, and I don't mean aldactone, we don't have trials, diuretics versus no diuretics. We kind of established the role of diuretics long time ago. It kind of makes sense if your patient is drowning because of the fluid in the lung. It makes sense to use it. Do we think it improves mortality? Well, if you don't give diuretics to the patient and decrease the overload of fluid, your patient will die. It's a common sense. But we don't have these trials comparing them to no diuretics. And it has been established a long time ago, so these trials will never happen anymore. Digoxin trial, there was a DIGE trial, which published, I think, in the mid-90s to late 90s, showing that it improves morbidity does not improve mortality as long as you keep the digoxin level between 0.5 to 1. After that, you start going into the toxic effect of the digoxin and the side effect of the digoxin. But it only improves morbidity, not mortality. These are the major treatment for this patient. Then recently, a few years ago, came the AHEFTA trial, which is a combination of hydralazine and mDUR. And that's where the idea of Bidil, the medication we use, and unfortunately we don't have generic of it yet, which is a combination of hydralazine and nitrate. Especially in African-American population, it showed decreased mortality. However, the recommendation is ACE inhibitor and beta blockers at the same time in addition to diuretics if needed. So therefore, using diuretics in this patient only for symptomatic relief. I have a few of my patients on no diuretics. They do have terrible cardiomyopathy, but they were never in fluid overload. So I don't use diuretics in them. It's not needed. It does not improve mortality in these patients. So these are the recommendations. You need to maximize the medication, either A, to reach the maximum dose of the medication, or B, maximum tolerated by the patient. Patient heart rates drop significantly to beta blockers. You need to stop. This is the maximum dose tolerated for this patient. After you do all of that, if you want to add hydralazine and mDUR, if your patient have enough blood pressure, even if they don't have coronary artery disease, you have to. But that will be step three to the management of this patient by adding hydralazine and mDUR. It's never step one. If your patient's creatinine does not tolerate adding ACE inhibitor or ARBs, then you go ahead and add the hydralazine and mDUR because you have contraindication to using ACE inhibitor and ARBs. So these are the common guidelines. Now, this is what we call the aquapheresis and ultrafiltration. I don't think we have it in the institution. This device costs around $28,000. And you see this one? It looks like a dialysis filter. One of these filters will cost $1,000. The treatment with this filter goes between 24 to 48 hours only. What's that? This is similar to small dialysis machine, except it takes only the fluid out of the body. When your patient is not responding well to diuresis, kidney trouble, and I don't mean they need dialysis. If they need dialysis, this is not a replacement for dialysis. This device, the aquapheresis device, and this is how we use it to get the fluid out of the body. It's a short PICC line, can be inserted by the PICC team, where the blood goes through here, and we can adjust how much fluid we take out of the body. So this device went through the unload trial. And the unload trial ended successfully, showing that this patient will have less stay in the hospital. It did not change mortality. It did improve, it protect the kidney in these patients. But the ACC guidelines give it a class 2 indication. Alpha filtration is reasonable for patients with refractory congestion not responding to medical management. And this is the unloaded trial. It showed that the ultrafiltration, they did better with the weight loss at the first 48 hours, significant P-wave difference, but the dyspnea score wasn't difference between them and the medical management. This is the medical management arm. So yes, it did well, took fluid out, less hospitalization for this patient, but the patient felt the same with both management. So, and again, the problem is it's very expensive. That filter needs significantly high PTT in order to run it. If the nurse forgets to change the bag on time, that filter will clot 1,000 pucks. So, therefore, a lot of hospitals don't have it, including ours. And actually, it takes a lot of patient. You need almost once a week management for these devices really to pay off. The other thing I want to talk about is ICDs. And I cut and paste, again, intentionally the guidelines. But I'll give you the summary of this. ICDs are indicated to manage patients with cardiomyopathy, not heart failure, cardiomyopathy, regardless of the etiology, if the ejection fraction is less than 35%. With, and that's important because they will not pay for your device. Optimal medical therapy. Patients should be on optimal medical therapy, well documented. Beta blockers, ACE inhibitor, and everything else. And then you re-image them again to see what happened to their ejection fraction. Patient with dilated cardiomyopathy, 9 months on maximum medical management, you re-image them again. If ejection fraction less than 35%, you put a device in as a primary prevention. We're not talking about secondary prevention here. This is only for primary prevention. Patient get into sustained ventricular tachycardia, they get a device, no matter where they are in the management. Optimal medical therapy. Patient with ischemic cardiomyopathy, they need at least 40 days post the revascularization or the event on good medical management. You re-image them again. No change. You put a device in them. Okay? But this is the key. You don't give them medication. You put a device. You send it to CMS. They reject your payment. And these devices are expensive. Not to mention, forget about the payment. Your patient will not benefit. These are foreign bodies. They tend to infect. Taking a device out could be a disaster for some of these patients. One time I had a patient where we had to take by VICD because of infection. Unfortunately, there was a big hole in his heart after they took it out, because this leads to fibrosis after a long time. Patient died immediately. He was waiting for transplant. So you got to be careful. If you put this device in and 2 months down the road, your patient responds wonderfully to your medical management, you didn't do them any favor. Now they don't need the device. You cannot take the device out. That device can be infected. It can shock them inappropriately. So you need to be careful not to put these devices except in these patients. We're talking ICDs. They mentioned dyssynchrony here for patients with BIV. I'm not going to talk about that. We'll leave that up to the cardiologist to decide what patient. But these are class 1 and class 2 indication in these patients, most of the time based on the criteria. So what you have to know for devices as emergency room physicians, that the ICDs are only for patients who are well managed. This is not an acute admission decision. This is an outpatient decision after appropriate medical management. There is no emergency required ICD placement in patient whatsoever. If your patient in ventricular tachycardia, you cannot get them out of it. They need to be managed medically. And after that, when they are stable, they get their devices based on the cardiology recommendations. You have to roll out ischemia before you put these devices. Patient should be appropriately managed. You have to find out what they have, ventricular tachycardia, first. Okay? And again, this recommendation only for primary prevention, not secondary prevention. That means patients who have the disease can cause the ventricular tachycardia, but they don't have it yet. To be indication. This is the MED2 trial, showed IC versus pharmacology therapy in patients with heart failure, ischemic cardiomyopathy mainly, that showed significant decrease in mortality hospitalization after the ICD placement, which makes sense because it cans lives. This is Scott Heff data, which published in 2005. This is the only data actually for non-ischemic cardiomyopathy patients where it showed significant improvement of mortality in patients with ICD versus the placebo or amiodarone. Actually, amiodarone and placebo, there was no difference between them at all in terms of mortality in these patients. The only thing prevent mortality is this. Now, I don't want you to think that amiodarone is bad for these patients. Patients who are symptomatic with ventricular tachycardia, you need to put them on some kind of antiarrhythmic medication. Mostly is amiodarone. This is the only medication actually approved for them. Some people use Dicosin as an off-label, which not recommended for ventricular tachycardia. But having a device doesn't mean allow our patient to go into ventricular tachycardia, because guess what's going to happen? They get shocked. This is not nice. You have them shocked to save their life, but don't have the shock as a way of management. It's nasty. Okay? So, amiodarone is recommended to manage, but actually it does not improve mortality. And just to let you know that when it comes to heart failure, especially when you're in an emergency room, you need some help with guidelines, go to the ACC website, acc.org. The guidelines is for free. This is the guidelines. This is the last updated guidelines. It lists everything for you. So that should be your Bible when it comes to heart failure. Now, what I want you to know, this is what to take home for you. Patient comes with heart failure symptoms. How are you going to work them up in the ER? A, remove CHF from your record, for God's sakes. I don't want to see it anymore. You want to know why Yes, you want to know why this patient in heart failure. You got to think, okay, my patient is presenting with heart failure symptoms. Fluid overloaded, overweight, lower extremities edema, neck veins up to here. There's an etiology. What happened? So you need to define the cardiomyopathy first. Is it ischemic, non-ischemic, or diastolic? Don't forget this etiology. And the problem with this one, we don't have much data to treat these patients. The only data is available is the ARB data with the CHARM trial. It's called CHARM Preserve. It had four arms. One of them is the diastolic heart failure patient, which showed that ARBs work for these patients. This is the only data we use. Anything else, we're extrapolating the data from the low ejection fraction data, the systolic dysfunction. So this is a troublemaker for us until this moment. We really don't have much data to treat this patient. So define it. What's the deal with this guy? Did he have an acute MI, went into failure, or he's well known to have it? So you have to know what's going on with this patient. So define the etiology, then move to the fluid status. Are they euvolemic or hypervolemic, or are they dry? Define the fluid status. And when you do that, define the perfusion status. Are they cold, low, or warm? Normal. When you define that, these are only three things I want you to think about it every time you see a heart failure patient. That will help you with the management. That will help you, should I give this patient Lasix? Or this is just cardiomyopathy issue, actually they are not fluid overload, or I need to give them fluid. Okay? You need to use your clinical skills, not just the VNP. Chest x-ray, clinical skills, EKG, all of that will help you. And that will tell you what's going on with this patient here. So after you define that, is he cold? Do I need to send this guy to the CCU because he needs to be on dibutamine or Merinol? Or they are warm, they can be on telemetry. Okay? These are the three slides I want them to stick in your mind after this lecture and use the guideline to guide you with the management of this patient. So when a patient comes to you, give me 1 second. When a patient comes to you, they are A, cardiomyopathy, acute heart failure, no CHF anymore. Because CHF, it means nothing to me. When I read somebody CHF, what does that mean? Does it mean have cardiomyopathy and they are rock stable? Or actually, they are cold and weight, I need to take them to the unit. All of that is coming under CHF. Therefore, actually, the American Society of Heart Failure Society of America have changed the terminology in 2005. Mainly after Dr. Stevenson paper came out, and they start defining these patients into A, the cardiomyopathy, and B, the fluid status. Therefore, instead of using CHF, we use AHF, which is acute heart failure. We're using cardiomyopathy, ischemic, non-ischemic, or diastolic. That's very important. Okay, now we're done. Questions? On this patient, the ACE inhibitor, for acute exacerbation, you should not use ACE inhibitor acutely as an IV medication, you mean?
Yeah.
It's not recommended, absolutely not. Hypertensive is a different story. You can give it all of them.
Okay.
I usually use PO. I never use IVS inhibitor. IVS inhibitor really has no role in improving mortality. Now, you have a hypertensive patient as a different story.
So a hypertensive heart,
it can be any fluid status with the ACE inhibitor, as long as you have good blood pressure. Just be careful with the creatinine. Now, the only thing you have to be careful with is IV beta blockers. Don't use IV beta blockers here. They can decompensate because they are still relying, remember the vicious cycle, they are still relying on this epinephrine to boost the cardiac output. If you do it at that moment of their decompensation, they might decompensate more. So you use IV for beta blockers if they are euvolemic or dry, if you need for hypertensive management. There's absolutely no role for IV ACE or IV beta blockers in stable patient for heart failure management only. If for hypertensive, that's fine, you can use ACE inhibitor. But what's better actually in these patients is using IV hydralazine or nitroglycerin, because nitroglycerin is vasodilator, decrease preload and afterload, and help you get rid of the pulmonary edema if you have pulmonary edema.
So the patient comes in with acute pulmonary edema, or if you go back even one more slide, I'm deciding if they are
back.
The other direction. Deciding if they're ischemic, not ischemic, as I saw.
As much nitro as you use, yes, you can. Absolutely. Think about it with the AHF trial. Now, you're using nitro for a short period of time to control blood pressure. If patients have good blood pressure, pulmonary edema, you want some help to your IV Lasix, use nitro. Some people use natricor. I didn't mention natricor because we can have hours of debate about natricor. But I sometimes use myself natricor. I look at the creatinine. I see if the patient are Lasix or diuretic naive, or they've been, for example, on 80 milligram of PO Lasix, but now they start decompensating. So I look at the whole picture rather than just looking at what number. But generally speaking, can you use nitro in these patients in general? Yes, absolutely. Just be careful with the aortic stenosis patient. Absolutely, you can. For decompensation, for hypervolemic, fluid overload.
How about that for the dry patient?
Oh yeah, dry patient, you got to be careful. Well, if they are dry, they are not in acute exacerbation, period. They might come to the hospital short, yeah, they come dry because they have, again, this one, they have the etiology of their heart failure. They might have ejection fraction 25%. Remember the example I gave you about my patient on Myrinone drip? It cannot get worse than that. She's requiring Myrinone to live. But yet, one day, over 2 days, she took her diuretics, and she didn't feel drinking. So she became dry. She came to the hospital weak. She dropped her cardiac output. Why? Because she didn't have enough volume. Her preload was down. Fluid is the solution here. So if somebody with heart ischemic, non-ischemic cardiomyopathy come to your emergency room weak, although the cardiomyopathy is above their head, we got to be careful. Are they here or are they here? Less or fluid? Because of that, good evaluation for these patients clinically. I check their skin turgor, check their neck, check their edema. Did you lose weight or did you gain weight? No, I lost 5 pounds in 2 days. I've been having diarrhea. Did you take your Lasix with it? Yeah, I've been taking my liver, but I couldn't drink. So they are dry. If they are hypertensive, which I doubt it in this patient, but if somebody, let's say, euvolemic, hypertensive with non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, can you use nitrate? Yes, of course, to treat hypertension. Other questions? Yes.
Low dose, nitro increases preload, and higher dose increases afterload.
Yes.
So that's why we can use the
Absolutely. Well, not immediate. You got to be careful. You don't want to drop their blood pressure. Yeah. Build it up.
20.
Absolutely. Because if you look at the dose I use for patients, especially hypertension patients, I have one patient on 160 milligram of M-DUR. They have good blood pressure. They never developed any bad side effect to it. Why not? It helps these patients. But build it up slowly. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.